We're holding Parshas Chukas, and as usual, we'll do a quick overview of the Parsha, and then we'll review it more in depth. Thank you. Our Parsha begins with the major chok, the major statute of the Torah, the major mitzvah, which is difficult to comprehend, and that is the mitzvah of Parah Aduma, the procession of preparing a red cow, which is... the ashes are... No, thank you. The ashes are later used for purifying a person who is tamei met, who is spiritually defiled from a dead person. And we will review the laws with more depth when we review it. The cow is slaughtered outside the Temple Mount, opposite the Temple Mount. It is burnt. Special leaves, branches are thrown into the fire. And then the ashes are collected and the ashes can be used to sprinkle on a person who became defiled to make him pure, with more details b'zachem later. The Torah tells us, how does a person get spiritually defiled? How does he become tamei if he touches a dead person? That is the highest level of tumah, the highest level of spiritual defilement, by touching him, by being in the same house, under the same canopy, the same tent as him, by touching a sword that touched a dead person, by touching a metal vessel that touched the dead person. And then the person would require this purification process, having the ashes with water sprinkled on him on the third day and the seventh day from when he became defiled. If one carries these waters, the special waters of the Parah Aduma, they become defiled. It's a fascinating thing that the waters are used to purify someone, and yet if someone carries them unnecessarily, they make him defiled. That's one of the things that defy our comprehension. Let's just quickly run through the parasha, and when we do more depth, we'll get to questions. We begin the 20th chapter, and the Jewish people come to the desert of Tzin. The Torah does not identify when this takes place. We have a tradition that this is at the end of the 40 years, that here the Torah jumps forward to the end of the 40 years, and Miriam passes away. Miriam is buried. We don't know why Miriam had to pass, couldn't enter the land of Israel. They had no water, because the well came by Miriam's merit. So when she passed away, they had no water. They come to Moshe and Aaron. The Erev Rav starts arguing with Moshe. They say, if we would have only died, now we're going to die of thirst. That's the worst death there is. Why'd you bring us out of Egypt to die in this bad place? This isn't the place you promised us. We're holding at the end of the 40 years. We're about to enter the Holy Land, and we still have Erev Rav in our midst. And they're insistent on sinning. This is the first sin of this generation. Moshe and Aaron come to the Ohel Moed. God appears. God tells Moshe, take your staff, gather the congregation, God says. God doesn't tell him to bring the Erev Rav, we're complaining. Gather them, you and Aaron, your brother, and go speak to the rock opposite their eyes. Let the people see that you speak to the rock, and the rock will give forth its waters. And then the congregation and its cattle will have water to drink. God is concerned for our money, our financial well-being, not only our physical well-being. Moshe takes the staff. He and Aaron gather the people. Moshe tells them, listen up, you rebellious ones. Am I going to take out water from this rock? You think that's a possibility? That's an impossibility. Moshe has stood there. He gave a speech and the water doesn't come forth. So he lifts his hand. He hits the staff. This is the second time that he did it. The first time in history, God actually told him to do it. That was 40 years earlier. And much water come out, and everyone drinks. And God tells Moshe and Aaron, you could have made a tremendous Kiddush Hashem if you would have maintained what I told you. I told you to speak, and you didn't speak. And because you didn't speak, so the Jewish people derived improperly from your actions. Either they could have understood a larger message that if the rock listens when God tells it, give forth water, then certainly we should listen, or else Moshe's error was in that he yelled at the Jewish people. He spoke to them out of anger, and really God wasn't angry, and that was a misrepresentation of God. And God says, due to this sin, Moshe and Aaron, will not bring the Jewish people into the land of Israel. And the question is, what was Aaron's responsibility? One possible answer is that Aaron should have stopped Moshe. Aaron was leading the people together with Moshe. He should have told him, hey, Moshe, wait a second, God isn't upset at them. They did nothing wrong. It was the Erev Rav that did something wrong. Moshe sends messengers. We're supposed to enter the land of Israel now. We're headed towards Israel. So Moshe sends messengers to the king of Edom and says, look, Our forefathers were brethren. You know that we took the responsibility of being in servitude for 400 years while you were able to live in this land. One of us had to do it, either Esav or Yaakov. We did it. Now God has taken us out of the land of Egypt to come back to our land. Let us come through. We won't harm your fields. We won't take your well water. We'll drink the stream water for free. And Edom tells him, no, I'm not letting you go through my land. So the people of Israel say, okay, so we won't go through the land. So let us go around your border. At least let us do that, and we'll pay you for the stream water, even though that's free water, the water in the rivers. But we'll pay you for that water that we drink. Let us go through. We won't do any harm. And Edom says, no. He goes out with heavy force, and he doesn't allow us to go through his border. The Jews are traveling, and they reach this double mountain called Hor Hahar. It's a mountain that's built like an esro. You know, an esro, according to some opinions, is supposed to be wide on bottom, closed in the middle, and wide on top again, like a figure eight. By the same token, this mountain was this double mountain, Hor Hahar. And God tells Moshe and Aaron, they're by the border of the land of Edom. Aaron has to pass away. He's not coming into the land of Israel because of the improper things that you did by Mei Meriva. Notice God calls it, Al Hashem Meritem et Pi. You were rebellious in Mei Meriva. What had Moshe told the Jewish people? Shimuna Hamorim, listen up, rebellious ones. What does God tell Moshe and Aaron? You too were rebellious in the way, in something that they did wrong. Take Aaron, take his son Elazar, take him up to the mountain, have you undress Aaron, dress his son Elazar, Aaron will pass away, and Elazar obviously is taking his place. Moshe does as God told him. Moshe undresses Aaron. He tells Aaron, lie down. Aaron lies down. He tells him, close your eyes. Aaron closes his eyes. He tells him, fold your arms on your chest. He folds his arms on his chest. Close your mouth. Close your mouth. And then Aaron passes away peacefully. And Moshe gives Aaron a pep talk before he goes. He tells him, Aaron, you should know, you're meriting to see something I won't merit to see. You get to see your son wear your clothing. Your son is going to be coin gadol after you. I didn't get that. I wasn't privileged. My children aren't taking my place. And Aaron passes away, and when Moshe sees the peaceful way, they enter this cave that God had prepared for Aaron. They see a bed that's set and made for Aaron. They see a candle lit. Everything's set in peace and tranquility, and Aaron's going to pass away that way. Moshe says, I wish I have that death. And Moshe's going to get his wish. The nation refuses to believe that Aaron passed away until God shows them, and everyone cries for Aaron's death because everyone loved Aaron. Moshe was the tough guy. Moshe was the one who kept telling them what to do and what not to do. And Aaron was the Kohen Gadol. He was the one who was befriending everyone. And everyone loved him. So men, women, everyone cried over Aaron's death. When Aaron passes away, so in Aaron's merit, because he made peace within the camp, God blessed us that we had protection outside the camp from our enemies. As we know, traditionally, the Jewish people, whenever there was peace in our midst, when our camp was in peace, we were always able to overcome our enemies. So when Aaron passes away, our magical clouds that God sent us to protect us, they disappear. And the Kenani, or whoever it was, Amalek, they thought that maybe God left them, and it's a sign that we could attack. So they're quick to attack. Yeah.
How long was the cloud gone
for? I don't know. It was gone for long enough that these people heard about it, and they attacked, and they took a captive. They took a maid into captivity, and the Jews took a vow. God, if you let us overcome this nation, then we'll give over everything we capture in God's name. And we overcome the Kenani, and even though the Torah doesn't identify it here, we know from later sources in Yeshua that the Jews didn't live up to this. There was a man named Achon who steals when the Jews say they'll give over all the loot from Jericho to God. So he steals from the loot in Jericho, and then in our next war against Ai, we lose the war. And God says the reason is because you didn't keep your word. You didn't give everything over to God. So our tradition has it that in this war as well, Achan stole. Achan from the tribe of Yehuda, he also stole from the loot. He had loot that he had stolen. And we're traveling the long journey around Edom, and the nation gets tired, and they start speaking badly about God, about Moshe. What did you take us out of Egypt for? This is so difficult. We're tired of this form of bread. And God sends two different types of snake, Nahash and Saraf, and the nation are bit, and many people die. They come to Moshe and they say, we've sinned, we spoke against you, we spoke against God. Pray to God and let him remove from upon us the Nahash that God sent because we spoke against him. And obviously they're alluding that they want Moshe to forgive them, because the Sarat came because they spoke against Moshe. So Moshe prays for the nation, and God tells him, okay, I'll forgive them my end, I'll take away the Nachash, but your end, that they spoke against you, that I sent the Sarat, that type of snake, for that you have to put up a cure, take a big Sarat, put it on a pole, and whoever gets bitten will see it and will live. And Moshe says, God, I'll forgive my end. I don't want it to be my end that they're punished for. And Moshe makes a Nachash Nechoshet. God told him, make a Sarat. Make the type of snake that I sent because they spoke against you. And Moshe says, no, no, I forgive my end, and I'll make a Nachash for what they spoke against you. So Moshe makes a Nachash of copper, which can be seen from the edge of the camp, and he makes it on top of a pole. And whenever a person was bitten by a Nachash, so he'd look at that copper snake and he'd remain alive. And from there you have what the doctors have, that sign of a pole with a snake. And we'll discuss it at greater length if we have time when we review it. We travel, and we reach a place where there were Mitzoraim who were in the back of the camp, and they saw a stream of blood flowing from a mountain behind the Jewish people, and they did some research and they found out that they were supposed to pass between two mountains, and the Kanani were prepared. They knew we were advancing, we're headed towards the land of Israel, the 40 years are up. So there had been a tribe that prepared within the mountains over there. There were two mountains facing one another, and in between there was a pass where the Jewish people had to pass. And they prepared in the caves of one mountain to throw rocks and destroy the Jewish people when they were stuck in between the mountains, to drop boulders down so that they'd destroy us when we were there. And they didn't know that the Aron travels before us, and when we travel, the Aron pushes the mountains out of the way. So one mountain had large rocks sticking out of it, another mountain had caves, and God made the mountains come together, and the rocks went into the caves. And when we passed, all we saw was those Mitzorom who were traveling behind us. They saw the stream of blood trickling down from between the mountains, and after some research, they verified that this is what had happened. So the Jews sang a song in honor of this. This is one of the Shirot. So, let's see. We're holding by Shvi. We want to come into the land of Israel. We send word to the great king of Sichon, Sichon, the great king of the Amori, let us pass through, and we won't harm you. We're just trying to get to the land of Israel. And Sichon refuses. He gathers his nation. He has a deal with the nations inside Israel that he'll protect them. And the last thing he wants to do is let us in. He's getting paid to ensure that we don't get into the land of Israel. So he gathers his troops, and he attacks us, and Moshe sees him and he's scared, and we destroy him and we conquer his land, and that's the tremendous land on the eastern side of the Jordan. We ordinarily would not have been able to conquer these lands, but God made it that Sichon, before attacking us, conquered part of the land of Moab. So now that he had captured the land of Moab, we could take it from him. God told us not to attack the Moabites. God still wants the Messiah to come from the Moabites, from Ruth. So God tells us, leave the Moabites alone. But this land, Sichon had captured a large part of the land from Moab, and now we captured it from Sichon. And this is also the introduction to next week's parsha. That's why Balak is so nervous. Because Balak says, what good does it do me that God promises them that God told them don't attack Moab? Whenever God wants, he just lets my land be taken by another nation, and then he gives it to the Jewish people to conquer from that nation. So Moab gets nervous when he sees that we easily overtake Sichon. Now, shortly before this story, Sichon and Moab had a war, and Sichon hired Bilam, the sorcerer, to come and curse Moab, and Bilam cursed them, and Sichon won the war. And that's how Sichon captured these lands. So now we captured these lands that had initially been Moabite territory, we captured them from Sichon. We send spies and capture the city of Yazer. We're traveling, and Og, the king of Bashan, comes out to attack us. And again, Moshe is scared, and God tells him, don't be scared, you'll capture him, and I'll let you conquer him like you conquered Sichon. And we conquer him, and that's the rest of the land on the eastern side of the Jordan. And now we're camping on the eastern side of the Jordan. This is our last station now. We're stationed at Arvos Moav. This is where the rest of the Torah is going to take place. We finished traveling. This is where we're going to be until we enter the land of Israel. At the end of our parsha, we've camped at Arvos Moav on the eastern side of the Jordan. Opposite us on the western side of the Jordan is Jericho. This is where Moshe is going to give us his last speech. The whole book of Dvarim is going to be recorded here. And from here, Moshe is going to pass away and we'll enter the land of Israel under Yoshua. So our parsha takes us the span of the 40 years. We jump forward in our parsha to the end of the 40 years and Miriam's passing away. And we don't have much information what happened during those 40 years. And our parsha takes us all the way to our last destination in the desert before we cross over to enter the land of Israel. Now let's review the parsha and try to get more depth. We mentioned that we're going to do half the class we're going to spend learning the parsha, and the other half we're going to review what we did in the first half of the book of Bamidbar. So I think that this way, if we pause every 4 weeks and take half a class to review, we hopefully will retain, and when we finish the Torah, we'll really know something. I hope. I find that every year I have to prepare again, so I forget it. So it's good for me to review, and I assume it's good for you too. Okay. Our parsha begins with the story of Parah Aduma. And really, this parsha is written out of place. Because when we erected the Mishkan on the 1st of Nisan, the second year we were in the desert, so then, on that 1st of Nisan, God told Moshe this parsha. This parsha is recorded over here, months later, after we've been decreed to be in the desert. When really, this parsha took place earlier, in Sefer Shmos, God told us this. God told us how to make the Parah Aduma, because a day after we erected the Mishkan on Beis Nisan, Aaron did this procession. He did the first Parah Aduma, and we needed it to be pure to do the second Korban Pesach in the second year. So this parasha is written out of place, and the question is why? Why is it written over here? So some want to say that it's written over here because the Jews were again impure as a result of the machlokas from Korach. All the dead men by Korach got us impure, so God recorded it here. Others want to say that in the end of last week's parasha, the Torah recorded all the different gifts and all the responsibilities of the Kohanim. So this is another responsibility of the Kohanim, so the Torah records it over here. Our parasha begins as though God is talking to Moshe and Aaron. We have 18 places in the Torah where God speaks to Moshe and Aaron. 13 of those places are commandments, where God gives us mitzvos through Moshe and Aaron. And in correspondence to the 13 places where the Torah says God spoke to Moshe and Aaron, we have 13 places where the Torah stresses that God spoke only to Moshe. And our sages have different interpretations of this. The more well-known interpretation is that the Torah gives Aaron the honor as though he was spoken to, but in truth, God only spoke to Moshe and Moshe said it over to Aaron. God is going to tell us a chukah. Zos chukas haTorah. This is the statute of the Torah. Chok, by definition, means something that we have trouble understanding. We know that when the smart child approaches his father and says, "Teach me about the Torah says, how's he going to approach his father? He's going to tell him, "Mahaidot v'chukim v'mishpatim." He breaks it down. The Torah is broken down to different types of mitzvahs. One of them is a chok. Chok is a mitzvah where, when we analyze it, logic seems to say this is paradoxical. We analyze the law and we're going to have trouble with it. And we're going to mention some of the issues with Parah Aduma. Let's do a quick overview. We're going to take only 2-3 minutes to review what actually happens with the cow. So we need a cow that's red, right? A red cow. It has to be a mature cow. It's a parah. It's not an egel, which means it's 3 or 4 years old and up. Now, once it has 2 hairs that are white or black at the root, even if at the top of the hair it's red, it's disqualified. The Parah Aduma is called a chatas, like an offering, that anything that would disqualify an offering disqualifies the cow. Meaning if someone had relations with the cow, or someone used it as a gift for a prostitute, or someone, or it has any blemish, all these things that Torah says disqualify an animal for being brought as a korban also disqualify the Parah Aduma. The Torah says it may not carry a yoke. And this means even if it doesn't do any work. There was once a non-Jew who had a Parah Aduma. He called the rabbis in. They inspected it. They said, yeah, it's perfect. So they agreed. He charged them a tremendous price. And then he went to the bar and told all his friends he's going to trick the rabbis. So the rabbis were going to come pick it up the next morning and bring him the money. And he took a yoke and he put it on the cow. And he said, now the cow's disqualified and the rabbis don't know. They come the next morning. They bring the money. And the non-Jew standing there, he's laughing inside. He's saying, "Nah, I really fooled them. They're going to pay me all this money and they're going to use this, and this is the source of all their purity, and it's disqualified." They look at the cow and they say, "We're sorry, the cow is invalidated." So he says, "What do you mean it's invalidated? Yesterday you said it was good." So he said, "Yeah, yesterday it was good. Today it's no good." So he said, "How do you know?" So they said, "We know. We're not." They didn't give away how they knew. They said, "We know. The rabbis had a tradition. There are two hairs on a cow that aren't bent unless the cow takes a yoke. And if a cow takes a yoke, a harness, even once, those hairs get bent and they never straighten again." So the rabbis knew to check those two hairs. So the day before, they checked the hairs. That day they came, he didn't know, so he lost his money. In our tradition, there were 10 paradumas. Moshe's paraduma lasted throughout the first temple, and the second temple saw another 8, and the 10th is going to be by the Mashiach. Now, paraduma is performed by a kohen gadol or a kohen hedyot. Any kohen can do it, but the kohen has to be dressed like a kohen hedyot, like a plain kohen. Our tradition has it, the oral tradition has it, that the paraduma may be done by someone who's not 100% pure. Meaning, let's say a person touches a sheretz, one of the 8 creepy crawly creatures, and he goes to the mikveh. A person lives with his wife, and he goes to the mikveh. So we say that after he goes to the mikveh, after he immerses in the mikveh waters, he has one level of purity, but he's not 100% pure until sunset. When the sun sets, then total purity sets in on him. That period after he immerses in the mikveh, before the sun sets, he is called a tvul yom, one who has toivod, and he's waiting for the day to end. Now, our tradition has it that he can make the paraduma. Throughout the period of the second temple, there were the Sadducees, the tzedukim, and they didn't believe the rabbis' oral tradition. They said, "We read the Torah, our understanding is just as good as the rabbis." And they held that if it's done by anyone that's not 100% pure, then the paraduma is disqualified. It doesn't work. Now, the rabbis kept trying to convince them that they're wrong, that they have to go with the rabbinic tradition. And they kept arguing that they don't believe it. Now, all their arguments were external. Most of them in their homes behaved like regular Jews. They held to the rabbis, they behaved like the rabbis, but on the outside they argued. On the inside, most of them knew that they were fakers. So the rabbis did a lot of things, to try and convince them to stop their arguments. And one of the things they did was this para aduma. Whenever they do this red cow, everyone that was involved would have to come to the mountain, Har HaZeisim, and they touch him with a sheretz. Now he's impure. Then he dunk in a mikveh. Now he's not completely pure. But according to our tradition, according to rabbinic tradition, he may do para aduma. According to the Sadducees, the para aduma he does is disqualified. So everyone that was involved in the para aduma was partially tamei. He had the minimum requirements so that the tzedukim, according to them, the paradum was disqualified. Now they had to admit to our tradition, or they would be or they would never be tahor. They didn't have a choice. This was one of the things they did. But because they had to do this, they were scared that people would come to be lenient with the paraduma. So they instituted many stringencies that have no source in the Torah to balance that out.
A 100%,
100%. That's not a nice word that you used, but it's definitely forcing our hand. 100% we forced our hand. Well, yeah, we force our hand. If a Jew walks in here and he's standing next to me and he says, "I'm going to turn on the light even though it's Shabbos." So I'll hug him and I'll kiss him and I'll take him out and I won't let him turn on the light. Sure, I grabbed him, I forced him, I forced my hand.
You take someone who's trying to be more machmir and saying, like,
no. So that's exactly the point. The Torah doesn't want us to be machmir. The Torah wants us to go according to the way the Torah wants. There's no such thing as more machmir.
The person has the right whether to turn. The person can decide for themselves whether turn on the light. It doesn't affect anyone else. This is something that they can't do. That they're
right.
At the mercy of other people.
100%. 100%.
It's like
we forced our hands. 100%. Right. If they don't want to admit, let them leave. We weren't encouraging them to stick around. We had no interest. There was a time that they had the majority in the Sanhedrin. The rabbis spent a lot of time arguing with them, and there was a real danger that they'd sway the Jewish people after them. This was a constant struggle throughout the time in the Second Temple. The Tzedukim and Baitusim were a serious threat. Some of the holidays that they celebrated, like Yom HaTzmaut, so they had inventive holidays in the Second Temple that the rabbis instituted. So some of the holidays were instituted in celebration of arguments that we won. That in the court, we won the Sadducees, so they made a day of celebration. No tachanun, no mourning, a day of celebration. This was a serious threat to Judaism, the movement of the Sadducees. So the rabbis forced their hand wherever they could, for sure. This isn't the only example. But because of this quote-unquote leniency, that anyone that was involved with the Parah Aduma would first have to be touched by a sheretz and then immersed, the rabbis instituted some fascinating stringencies. And now we're going to enumerate some of them. The Kohen Gadol, we have a tradition, before the Kohen could do the Parah Aduma, he'd have to leave his home for 7 days. So the rabbis instituted that he has to leave his wife as well. The room that he was in, every vessel was made of stone, because stoneware cannot become tamei. No Kohen would touch him. He'd be like an untouchable. For 7 days, no one would come close to him, no one would touch him. Every day of the 7 days, we'd sprinkle on him from the Parah Aduma. Maybe, perhaps, he was tamei meis and he didn't know about it. Maybe he was spiritually defiled, so we'd sprinkle it on him. The person who would sprinkle on him every day of the 7 days was a person who was never tamei in his whole life. How do you get a person who was never tamei in his whole life? So they take women who were pregnant, and they take them to a mountaintop, where they had that mountaintop verified that the land on it was barren, was a sela, a stone where they knew no one ever dug in that stone and buried anyone there. And under that stone, they'd make a hollow to ensure that if there was a dead man down there, the purity didn't shoot up beyond that stone. The women would live there in complete purity on that mountaintop, and over there they'd bear their children, and the children would never leave that mountaintop. They'd stay there learning until it came time to sprinkle on the Kohen, who would make the Parah Aduma. Then they'd bring two cows and lay a door on those cows and take the children on that door, and that ensured that in case there was a dead man buried along the way, we have a tradition that the tumah shoots up until there's a gap, until there's a hollow. Once there's a gap of a certain size, it stops within that gap. So now there's a gap. They're sitting on the doors. These cows would take the children down to the river to draw the water. They'd bend over the cows, draw the water, bring it to the Kohen, and these children who were grown from the womb, they were the ones who sprinkled on the Kohen Gadol. The way, the path in which they travel was on a bridge. There was a bridge going from the temple to the Har HaZeisim, and that bridge was built again. It had arches, and the way the arches were built, it was double arches, so that wherever you had a beam of the arch, you had a hollow of another arch above it to ensure that the tumah couldn't shoot up. All of these stringencies are beyond what we need to be choshesh for according to the letter of the law. But because we applied certain leniencies, so the rabbis instituted many stringencies to counterbalance that. And don't forget that this is the source of our purity. We're going to use these ashes for our purity. Okay, we're going to skip the rest of the details. Those of you who want, last year we spent a good 20 minutes, half hour describing it. You could get the class on the web, or I'll post a summary on the board. I want to move forward. I want to deal with some other points tonight. We have a targum. We have a tradition that when God gave us the Torah, he gave us the Torah together with the translation. And that translation was handed down to the rabbis until Unkelos, the Ger, transcribed it. And that targum goes back to Sinai. That's a targum Unkelos that our rabbis instituted we should read every week. In many Mikot Gdolot, you'll see another targum which we don't know where it's from. It says over it, Tof Yud. And some say it's Targum Yonasan. The only problem is the Gemara says that Yonasan never wrote a Targum on the Torah. So it's not Targum Yonasan. So some say it's Targum Yerushalmi. And we don't know where that Targum is from. In our Parsha, there are examples of where that Targum contradicts our oral tradition. And many pens have been broken trying to explain what the Targum meant. Because he says things that contradict the Mishnah and the Gemara in his explanation of the Parah Aduma. He says, for example, that they dip and they dip in the blood and sprinkle 7 times from one dipping. And our tradition is that each time they dip it a separate time. Our tradition is that Israelite may collect the ashes, and he says that a Kohen must collect the ashes. There are contradictions. So some want to say, the conclusion that most have come to, is that it's supposed to be Tof Yud stands for Targum Yerushalmi, and was a man who lived in Jerusalem who was a Karaite. He was a Karoi. And that's why some of the things that he writes don't go in line with our tradition, because he was a Karai. That's what researchers say, and one of their main proofs is our Parsha. I was hoping David would be here. Send him my regards. We're going to discuss a little bit the deep philosophy that's behind Parah Aduma. And the first thing Rashi tells us is that there was a king who his son, the prince, comes in and he throws up and he gets the pails dirty. So what does the king say? Call his mother and let her clean up after him. By the same token, the Para Aduma is coming on our tradition to correct the chet of the Egel. The Egel was a young calf, the son of a cow. And now the mother, the cow, is going to atone for the chet Egel. What does that mean? Man was created, the initial plan was he shouldn't die, right? God told him, don't eat from the forbidden fruit and you won't die. Adam Rishon ate from the Eitz Hadas, and death was decreed upon the world. We reached Sinai and got to Luchos, and there we have tradition Paskazu Amatan. The filth that we got from the initial Nachash had ended, and by the same token, we had overcome the Chet of Adam Rishon, we might not have died. The plan was, we're accepting the Luchos, and now we're accepting God's Torah, we won't die. And then the Jews sinned with the golden calf. Now, once they sinned with the golden calf, they went back down to the level of Adam Rishon after a sin with the forbidden fruit. God had said, Ani amati Elokim atem, we say in Shir Shel Yom, God said, I want them to be godlike, they shouldn't have death. But Kadam Temutun, they're going to die like Adam Arishon, like the original man. And the Parah Aduma comes to bring some atonement for the Chet of the Egel. The Chet of the Egel is when death was returned to the world, and the Parah Aduma gives us the purity from the death, right? When a person touches a dead man or is in the same tent, he gets impure. The Torah says, V'ikhu ilecha, we take the golden calf because we were the ones who took off our jewelry and gave it to the golden calf. We take the Parah Aduma. We take a red calf because they sinned with their gold, and sin is called red. We take a whole calf because the Jews were whole until they sinned in the Egel. A calf that didn't have a yoke because we removed the yoke of heavens from upon us. We give it to Elazar the Kohen because Aaron was the one who sinned with it. He burns the cow, the Egel was burnt. We throw in three different types of Eitzer, Zezov, and Shnit Olas because 3,000 people died when we sinned with Egel. The Parah made us, makes a person who's pure Tameh. By the same token, the Egel made us Tameh. And the ashes of the Parah makes those that are Tameh the whole, so too the ashes of the Egel purified the nation. This is supposed to be watching for the Jewish people. We know that the sin of the Egel is watched by God because the Jewish people sinned. God said, every time I punish them, I add a little bit for the Egel. How are we to understand this concept of spiritual impurity, Tumah, that God gives to the world when man dies? We know that man is holy, and when man passes away, God wants us to respect the corpse. There's a concept of Kavod Abrios. It's so important to respect the human being that if even the high priest encounters a corpse and there's no one around to bury it, he must bury that corpse. But he's on his way to do the Yom Kippur services. Yeah, we say it doesn't matter. His first responsibility now is to respect that human being that died. So we see that the body, even after the neshama leaves it, even after the body is dead, the body deserves a lot of respect. And the question is, then why is there such great spiritual defilement? Why is there such tumah from the body? So, David, you came just in time. It was hurting me to say this when you weren't here. The Gemara tells us that there are three types of angels that are problematic to mankind. There's the Satan, there's the Malach HaMavis, and there's the Yetzer Hara. And the Gemara says they're one and the same. So the Ramban, in his introduction to Job, in his introduction to Eov, says that he presents a few opinions. He says the first opinion is, these aren't forces from within, these are external angels. The Satan is an angel, as seems to be clear in Job and in the story we'll read next year of Bilam. The Malach HaMavis is an angel that gives death, because death, says the Ramban, is not just the absence of life, but death has to be implemented by an angel that collects the neshama and makes the person dead. And this is the direction we're going to go to in a minute, that when this angel kills a person, it's not only that he's taking the neshama out, but he's putting something negative in. And then there's the Yetzer Hara. The Gemara says he has seven names, but we don't have time for that tonight. The Gemara in Sukkah, Nun Beis Amud Aleph, if you want to look it up. When Adam and Eve were walking around Gan Eden, so the snake, the Nachash, came and seduced Eve. And from that came out the force of Samael. Now, the Malach HaMavis, the fact that this angel has the ability to give death in the world, that goes back to Adam and Chava, right? To Adam and Eve. Because before they ate from the forbidden fruit, there wasn't supposed to be death. God told them, you eat from it, there'll be death. And when the angel makes a person die, so it's not like a sheretz. When we have one of the eight creepy crawly creatures, when they're dead, so life has been taken out of them, and what remains is defiled. So their essence, their physical essence, is spiritually defiled. Those eight creepy crawly creatures. A human isn't that way. A human, his even his physical being is something that's supposed to be honored. The Torah commands us, if you hang a person, so you can't leave it there overnight. He must be buried. We buried the dead of our enemies when we fought a war. So the body is something we respect. So then why is it that it has tumma? The tumma, the spiritual defilement, stems from the fact that when the person is put to death by the angel, he's put to death similarly to when the snake seduced Chava. Some spiritual defilement is put in by the angel. It's not that the body is tameh and now what's left is the tumah. No, it's that the body is holy and the neshama is holy. But when the malach comes and takes out the neshama, he leaves behind his implantation of tumah. That's one understanding. If we could just take 1 second just to open a thought. The para is aduma, is red. Red represents chet. Red is Edom. Edom is the nation of Esav. Esav, their land is Sa'ir. Sa'ir is the Hebrew word for shed. Yeah? Just something to think about. Why the para aduma is what's going to correspond to the Nachash, which initially brought death to the world. The para, yeah? Oh, that's red. Okay. Ah, so that I don't think we'll get to tonight.
It seems to be connected with all the snakes biting.
Right. Yeah, it does seem to be connected. What?
Copper is reddish in color.
Copper is reddish, right? Okay, we're short on time. The Torah tells us that if someone touches a dead man, he becomes tameh. So long as one is touching a dead man, he has a great level of tumah. It's not just after one touches it, but when one is touching it, he has a greater level of tumah. So much so that if he touches someone else, then we consider tumah b'chibrin, as though there's an attachment. It goes forward. Any metal vessel that was in a home or that touched the dead man also becomes tameh, almost as bad as the dead man himself, or as the corpse itself. Yeah.
Does a non-Jew possess the same ability to transfer
that? Non-Jews do not become tameh. Non-Jews, when they are alive, do not become tameh. Animals also do not. There's a question in the Gemara: what about a Jewish woman who's carrying a fetus that died? So we derive from the psukim, the Torah says, anyone that touches a dead man on the face of the field, and the Torah is coming to stress the dead man must be revealed like a dead man lying in the field. If a woman is carrying a fetus which unfortunately has died within her, that fetus is not tameh till it comes to the airspace. We also have a tradition that golel v'dofek, the tombstone, is tameh. So what happens if you take a cow, you take an elephant, and you say, this elephant is the tombstone over this grave. And you plant the elephant there, so then halachically that is the only case where a live animal can become tamei. Because if that live animal is the tombstone, so that live animal becomes tamei. That's a tradition we have, that kolel v'dofek, a tombstone, a cover to a grave, becomes tamei even if it's a live animal. That's the only way you could have an animal becoming tamei. I don't remember. It's a good question. I have to check. I don't remember. No. It's a good question. I don't remember. The Torah tells us if a person is defiled and he enters the Mikdash or the Mishkan, so he has defiled it. Now, by just walking into the Mishkan, we don't defile it. Only the corpse or the sword that or metal instrument that touched the corpse or was in the tent with the corpse, only they make Tumah Be'ol within a tent. If a person who's Tameh walks into the Beit HaMikdash, he didn't make it defiled. So here we see that the concept of Tumah doesn't only refer to defilement, it also refers to bringing something down, treating it with less respect. And by the same token, Tum'ah is also a reference to uncleanliness. If a person washes his hands and he doesn't dry them, and then he goes to make hamotzi and eat bread, so his hands are still wet, and then he's going to touch the bread with his wet hands, so that's uncouth. That's not spiritually defiled, and that's called tameh. That's called that he's eating the bread tameh. Tum'ah doesn't only mean spiritual defilement. We have something fascinating here. The Torah says whoever sprinkles the ashes of the Parah Aduma, of the red cow, he becomes Tameh. And our tradition has it that that's not so. That if you carry an amount of ashes with water that's good for sprinkling, then you become Tameh. But the person who actively sprinkles it, he does not become Tameh. And that's a fascinating thing, that the Torah says one way, and our tradition says, no, it's not that way. It's a different way. Think about it. Think about what that means. I mean, you have a verse that clearly states one way, and our tradition says, no, it's talking about something else, and the simple understanding of the pasuk is just not so halachically. I don't remember the number. I don't remember. Yeah, that's one of the paradoxes, yeah. But if a healthy person takes medication, it'll affect them one way. And if a person that's ill takes medication, then it'll help them. So that doesn't seem to be the major paradox that causes the Parah Adum to be called the Chok, even though that is the general understanding as to why it's called the Chok. So 40 years pass in a blink of an eyelash in the Torah. And now Miriam passes away. And right away after she passes away, she's buried. And this teaches us that we should rush in burial. We derive it from Miriam. Right after a person passes away, we should try to bury them. We try not to detain the corpse. Out of respect to the corpse, we try to bury it, especially a woman. Especially a woman, because women have more bodily fluids coming out after they pass away. It's considered disrespectful to let the body start decomposing that way and not bury it. Yeah. There is what to say, but that deserves a separate class. But what happened during those 40 years? The Torah doesn't tell us. So that's a discussion, but we're skipping a lot of stuff in the parasha. That's not for now. So long as Miriam was alive, we had water by her merits. Did anyone know that? When she passes away, suddenly we're lacking water. And that's something to think about. Very often we don't know what we're lacking till we're lacking it. Very often when people consider leaving yeshivas or switching yeshivas, I tell them what my rabbis told me. You won't know what you had here till you leave here. I can't tell you what it was. Maybe it was that the class was air-conditioned, and that helped you focus. Maybe it was the lunches. Maybe it was the bedroom. Maybe it was the friends. Maybe it was the location. There are many aspects which you can't even appreciate till you lose them. And until Miriam passes away, I don't know if anyone knew that it was in her merit that we had the water. When she passed away, we lacked water. And when we lack water, the nation comes to Moshe and asks him for water. And the Erev Rav come and they make a turmoil. And they start complaining, and this is what we're holding by entering the land of Israel. It's the end of the 40 years. This is the first time we have a problem. What was Moshe and Aaron's sin? So the Rambam says that they caused the Jewish people to think that God was upset at them when really He wasn't. Rabbeinu Hananel says that they said, "Hamin asela zen notzi," we will take out water. They used the word that indicated as though they had the power to do it, and really they didn't. The Ramban says the truth is, it's a secret. Look at the Ramban, so he says. He says there's a true secret shot here that's the depths, and then I can't understand what he says beyond that. Let's take 1 minute just to analyze what happens when a person gets upset. According to the Rambam, Moshe Rabbeinu's sin was that he got upset. The Pasuk teaches us in Mishlei that there are two levels in controlling one's anger. One is Erech HaPayim, one who's slow to anger, meaning someone walks up to you and smacks you in the face. You could give him a shot in the eye, or you could wait and wait and think, and after 2 days walk over and give him a shot in the eye. That you're slow to anger, you think it through? What, does he deserve it? Doesn't he deserve it? After 2 days, it's, yeah, okay. So you walk. So that's one level. That's still a good level. That's Erech HaPayim. Then there's a second level, and that's Moshel Beruchot, one who really controls his spirit. He's not just slow to anger. He doesn't anger. He controls whether he gets angry or not. So Shlomo Amelech tells us, Tov Erech HaPayim Migibo. One who's slow to anger is better than a brave person, than a brave warrior, because he controls himself. He can wait. A warrior, he's a warrior, but he doesn't have control over himself necessarily. But Moshel Beruchho, if one can control his spirit fully, that's better than Lochedir, one who captures a city. And that's also what Shlomo Amelech said, Sechel Adam Erichapo. Man's wisdom will give him length of anger, or slow before he angers. V'tifarto. But his glory is Avor Al Pasha, when he could totally disregard when someone treats him in a brazen manner. Evil, the fool, Bayom Yivadaka, so the day he gets angry, you find out his anger. Kol Ruho Yotzikasil, the fool gives out his wind right away. And Chazal warned us to be careful not to anger. Elio told Rav Yehuda, he told him, Lo Tirtach Lo Techti. If you don't get upset, you won't sin. You want a protection from sinning? Don't get upset. Control your anger. The Gemara tells us there are three people who God loves: a person who doesn't anger, a person who doesn't get drunk, a person who doesn't hold people to the T with giving him what he deserves. There are three that God hates: one who speaks one way and really means another way, one who can testify for his friend and says, why should I go help now, why should I testify, and one who comes and testifies singularly when he knows the courts won't accept his testimony. There was Tuvia, who sinned, and his friend Zigud walked into court and says, I saw Tuvia sinning and I warned him and he deserves to get lashes. So Rav Papa, who was Rava's Talmud, he said, bend over, and they gave him lashes. So he said, Tuvia chata, Tuvia sin, v'zigud mingud, and Zigud gets hit. So Rav Papa said, yeah, what'd you walk in here and tell us for? You know we can't accept testimony unless there are two. You're one, so you're just coming to give him a bad name. We can't accept your testimony. You want to give him a bad name? That's biblically prohibited, so you get lashes. The Gemara tells us that if one tears his clothing out of anger, one breaks something out of anger, one even scatters his money out of anger, then we look at him as though he served idols. Because the way of the Yetzer Hara is that once he gets control, one day he tells us to do this, the next day he tells us to do that. And that's something which is an important concept. Sometimes we look at the political leaders and we say, oh, they're dirt, they're scum, how could they do this or that or the other thing? And I'm not saying that they're correct in what they're doing. But when we look at them, we should first look at ourselves. Do we control our Yetzer Hara? Do we have control over what we do correctly or incorrectly? So what's the difference between us and them? That our choices have less effect on other people. They have a responsibility to do right. But I'm not sure that we could judge them. We don't know where they're holding. Anger is one trait where the Rambam says we have to go to the opposite extreme. The Gemara teaches us, Shlosha chayim enam chayim. There are three people whose lives are worthless. A person who's angry, a person who's quick to anger, a person who's, what are the other two? I don't remember. A person who has too much mercy. If you care for everything you see that goes bad, so then you're always hurting. There's always going to be things that are improper. And a person that's too sensitive, a person that he's finicky. So if his bed isn't made exactly right, if the temperature in the room isn't exactly right, if the meal wasn't exactly right, everything bothers him. And Rav Yosef, who was blind, he said, boy, that's terrible, because I have all three. Moshe Rabbeinu's error in Mei Meriva, according to the Rambam, was that he angered. That he spoke to the Jewish people and he said, Shim'una Hamorim, listen, rebellious ones. He spoke to the Jewish people out of anger. There's a pirush called Ri Ibn Shu'ib, disciple of the Rashba. And if I understood him correctly, I think what he means to say is as follows. We know Moshe Rabbeinu didn't die at the hands of the Malach HaMavis. God himself took his soul. But the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu let the Malach HaMavis enter him, because we said the Malach HaMavis is the Satan, is the Yetzer Hara. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu got angry. So who's in control when a person's angry? He's not in control. He's letting the Yetzer Hara be in control. So there was a moment in Moshe's life where he let the Malach HaMavis take control of his life. That's what ultimately allowed him to take control of his life at the end of his life, even though it wasn't really the Malach HaMavis who put him to death. Yeah?
How many days was it since Miriam's death until he got angry?
I don't know.
Because if my sister died, I'd be very angry too.
Okay.
So it makes sense.
I hear.
Stress and some bad things happen, it's easier to anger when you're stressed.
I hear. Well, he got upset at the Jewish people, not at the Erev Rav. He was held to task because the Jewish people didn't deserve to be yelled at like this. They weren't complaining. The ones complaining were the Erev Rav. I didn't say they did wrong. I was just saying one understanding as to what Moshe did wrong. Okay. The Yetzer Hara is a blessing. When God created the world, he said it's Tov Mod, it's very good, that's the Yetzer Hara. And if not for the Yetzer Hara, our sages tried at one point to quiet down the Yetzer Hara, no one got married, no one built a house. We can't live without the Yetzer Hara. That's the spice in our life. The Gemara says that the Yetzer Hara is like the sourdough when you're making dough. You want the dough to rise. You have to add yeast. Yeast doesn't taste good, but the right amount of yeast, that's what makes good bread. By the same token, the right amount of Yetzer Hara, that's what makes our lives good. Without Yetzer Hara, life isn't good. So God gave us a blessing, the Yetzer Hara. And the Jewish people complained about that blessing. They complained to God, and they said, why'd you give us a Yetzer Hara? He makes us sin, he makes us err. They complained to Moshe, they say, he gave us so many mitzvahs, how could we handle the Yetzer Hara? Throughout our 40 years in the desert, God didn't tell us there's a good well down there, there's a good stream going underground in the desert over there. God could have given us water in many ways, and God did not. Instead, God had Moshe hit a rock, and from that rock came forth water. And God was giving us a message. Our hearts are sometimes compared to rocks. And that's because when we look at the Torah, and we read the way of the Torah, we feel like, this doesn't fit with me. I have a different tendency, I have a different nature. How am I ever going to do this? And the Jewish people were fresh. They were coming straight out of Egypt. They were coming after a lifetime of living immoral and lives with the worst moral culture, the Egyptians. And here they were coming, and God's giving them a whole series of 613 laws, a whole Torah, which they felt was unnatural. So God told them, the Torah is like water. The Torah is cold water. And God said, I'm going to give you water from the rock by hitting the rock. Because sometimes when we first approach the Torah, it feels like we're being hit. We have to bend ourselves. It's like a rock. This doesn't fit with me. So slowly, we learn the ways of the Torah, and slowly the water comes forth. And just like the rock naturally does not give forth water, so too mankind naturally would not live up to the Torah. But why was the rock able to give forth water? Because God helped it. God said, rock, give forth water. By the same token, God helps us. If we want to go in the way of the Torah, then God will help us. Doesn't mean it'll be easy, but God will help us. Now at the end of the 40 years, I'll get to you in just one second, at the end of the 40 years, we're holding by a different generation. That's the generation that your children are going to be. That's a generation that was born to a Torah-keeping family. They're not coming into this off of Egypt. They're coming into this after 40 years living Jewish in the desert. So this generation, when they need water, they don't need to be hit like their forefathers. They need to be spoken to. Our children, they're going to have it easier to keep the Torah. Doesn't mean they won't have tests, but their hearts aren't going to be like the hard rock. So God tells Moshe, now it's a different generation. Speak to the rock. Moshe comes before the people, and they've made a fuss. And Moshe gets upset. And Moshe tells them, listen, rebellious ones, you're not ready for this. And he hits the rock. And God says, they were fine. You were upset at them, but they were fine. They asked for water. They complained, but the Jewish people, they didn't need the rock to be hit. And Moshe Rabbeinu's, his view of the Jewish people as being inadequate and unworthy of getting the water by their merits, their hearts being like a stone, that was the error that Moshe had in the beginning of his career. When God came to Moshe and told Moshe, take out the Jewish people, Moshe said, I can't take him out. Moshe Rabbeinu said, Lo ish dvarim anochi, the last letters are Shammai. Moshe Rabbeinu said, I am a man of justice. I am a man who always sees things the letter of the law. And with the letter of the law, how can they ever deserve to go out? And Moshe Rabbeinu, and God tells Moshe, no. Eheyeh asher eheyeh, God tells him. Letters are 21 and 21 multiplied by one another. They come out to be, what? 441, right? The gematria of emet. God tells them with emet, with justice they deserve to get out. What do you mean? The Jewish people, they have the merits. They didn't intermarry. They didn't change their names. They maintained Zionism. They maintained the basic mitzvos that they had in the land of Egypt. They maintained. They do have merits to leave. And Moshe Rabbeinu goes to Paro and things get worse. And then he comes back to God and he says, why'd you send me? If you would have sent my brother Aaron, he's a man who's more gentle, he's a man who's more forthcoming, he's like Hillel, who yiyeh lecho lepeh, Rosh Tevos Hillel. My brother Aaron, he would have done it right. Why did things go bad? Because I came, and I don't see the justice of the Jewish people. I don't see that they deserve to go out. So God tells him, Atatire, okay Moshe, you don't see their merits, that they deserve to go out. And therefore, Atatire, you will see now, in the present, you will see the miracles that I do and take them out of Egypt, but you will not see when I take them into the land of Israel. God isn't punishing him at that moment. God is foretelling him. This weakness that you have, that you can't see the merits of the Jewish people, when you're dealing with them and they complain and things seem difficult, you say, well, they didn't deserve it. That's ultimately going to be your downfall. And that's what happens 40 years later in our parsha. Just 1 second. David, yeah.
If in Rashi it says that when he hit the rock, it was like the wrong rock.
There is such a medrash, 100%.
So, but how can you get confused of the big rock that's falling around 40 years with another rock?
So, we don't know what the size of the rock was. It's called a tsur, it's called a sela. Tsur is one kind of rock, sela is another kind of rock. Rashi says that the rock, being that it was of no longer use, it went and hid itself between other rocks. Whatever that means. That's what Rashi says. And then there are different midrashim, whether the Jewish people told them, if God sent you, so take water out of this rock. What difference does it make? And Moshe asked them, what do you think? I can take water out of that rock, you rebellious ones. God didn't say out of that rock. It won't work out of that rock. That's one midrash. There's another midrash that he tried the wrong rock and God made it work anyways when he hit it the second time.
Well,
there are different...
Also, yeah.
They were egging him on.
He was angry before that.
I don't know that he was angry before that. We see he's angry when he says Shimuna Hamorim. That's when we see he's angry. Before that, we don't see it. Yeah.
Hadn't Moshe not seen the merits of the people? So many times he sees the praise for them, and he shows them the merits.
So two things. I'm happy you brought that up. In truth, we should have said this in the introduction. Whenever we discuss a fault of someone in Tanakh, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, we have to recognize that if you think of the galaxy, think of the size of the galaxy. Think of a grain of sand at the edge of the beach. How many trillions of grains of sand are there? What's the worth of that grain in respect to the whole galaxy? Minuscule, right? That's the distance between us and understanding Moshe Rabbeinu.
Wow.
Wait, slowly. Hey. So we have to really temper what we're saying. We're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's leap forward 1,000 years, okay? Time of the destruction of the Second Temple. We've had almost 5 centuries without a prophet, 3-4 centuries without a prophet, and we're holding after the destruction of the Second Temple. The Jewish people are downtrodden. That's it. We don't have the source of holiness. The Second Temple was lacking 5 of the signs of godliness of the First Temple. And after its destruction, we're holding Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's time, Rebbe. Okay? So the Jews have had a long time to descend on the ladder of spirituality. And Rebbe's learning Chavrusa with Antoninus. And Antoninus comes into Rebbe. And he sees a student there. Now, whenever Antoninus would leave his palace, he'd take 2 guards with him. One he'd kill when he entered Rebbe's home, and the other he'd kill when he'd get back home, so that no one would know he's learning about Judaism. So Antoninus comes into Rebbe's home, and he sees a student there, and he tells Rebbe, "How could you do this to me? I'm coming to learn Torah by you. I trust you that you won't divulge my secret that I'm studying about Judaism, and you have a student present when you know I'm coming." So Rebbe sends the student to the door. He says, "Resuscitate, bring back to life that guard that's standing that he just killed when he entered our house." So the student comes back with the guard that was dead. He comes back with him walking alive. Santonino says to Rebbe, he says, "So what? I know your small students could do Tchias HaMeisim. That's supposed to impress me." That's Antoninus' response. So let's think. We're talking about 1,000 years later. That's Rebbe. Over 1,000 years later. Rebbe didn't have prophecy. It's Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, who's a Tana, he's an amazing person. He's way beyond our comprehension. He's Rebbe Yehuda HaKadosh, and that's his disciple. But that's still 1,000 years away from Moshe. And that's something which Antonina says, "I know your small students could do that." So we're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. We're talking about a person who is the height of prophecy, which means that he had the height of control over his midot, his traits. But the Rambam says one of the things we see is that there's no such thing as perfection. Everyone's going to have errors. Even Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't perfect in his traits. There's no such thing as perfection. We strive for perfection, but we shouldn't be bothered by the fact that we don't attain it. No one attains it. We have to keep working to fix ourselves and to move forward. But when we use these terms that Moshe was upset and the people got him angry, we're using terms that are borrowed terms. We're applying them from our perception. We're bringing Moshe down to our level. It's like an inherit the wind, he says. God says he created man in his fashion. Man creates God in his fashion. We have a tendency to bring everyone down to our level. And by the same token, we talk about Moshe Rabbeinu, we bring him down to our level. So I present it in a way that's more easily understood. But by the same token, we have to begin this conversation by recognizing we don't understand Moshe. We don't begin to understand anything about Moshe. What does it mean that man talks to God on a one-to-one basis whenever he wants and he maintains his faculties? We don't begin to understand it. By the same token, we don't begin to understand his anger. So that's point number one. And point number two, Moshe Rabbeinu is protecting the Jewish people. Again, I'm going to go back to talking to Moshe Rabbeinu as though he was my buddy sitting here next to me. Just for the sake of more easily understanding the concept. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu can go to bat for the Jewish people in protecting them, in presenting them, and telling God not to wipe them out, if we look, Moshe Rabbeinu's claim is always, "This won't work from your perspective, God." He doesn't say they have the merits. He always says, "God, this will be desecration of your name. This will be this, that, the other thing." It's true that he goes to bat for the Jewish people. But if we're working as though we understand Moshe, so that's not necessarily such a strong question. And the last point, going back to what Zev said, so when we say there was something lacking in Moshe's perception of the Jews' merits, we're talking about a person who was able to pray for them more than us. God takes him as a prototype, as an example to the other prophets and says, learn from Moshe. Look how he stood up for the Jewish people. When I said I want to do something bad, he stood up for them. You have to learn from him how to stand up for the Jewish people. So it means that on some level, by comparison to his greatness, it wasn't right. The Gemara records that Abaye heard a guy and a girl talking. And they said, let's get up early in the morning and travel out together. So Abaye said, I'll follow them and I'll help them overcome their ill inclinations and they won't sin. So he follows them. And they end up traveling 4 hours, three parsha, so the Gemara says, and he's traveling behind them and they don't know he's behind them. And finally they hit a fork in the road and they say, it was so nice traveling together, but we're both headed to places that are so distant from one another, we'll have to separate our paths now. And they go separate ways. And Abaye comes home, the Gemara says, and he walks on the doorpost and he leans on the door and he says, I don't get it. If I would have been he, I wouldn't have walked away from that girl. You know what? I wouldn't have walked away without sin. How could he just walk away and say, yeah, I got to go this way, you got to go that way. We'll each have a good life. If I would have been in his shoes, I wouldn't have been able to walk away from sin. I wouldn't have been able to do it. So Abaye is standing in the doorway and he's feeling really bad about himself, saying, this man, he was walking alone with a girl, he was over on Halacha, he was with Yichud, and something could have happened, and I was there, I was going to tell him, hey, don't do it, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and then he didn't do it. They just decided on their own, okay, we won't do it. How could it be that if I would have been in his shoes, I wouldn't have lived up to that test? And Abaye was standing there feeling bad. Until along came Ahu Zaken, Ahu Saba, an old person, according to some Elio and Avi, and he taught Abaye a rule. He said, Kol ha-gadol mechavero, whoever is greater than his friend, yitzlo gadol emenu. He's got a bigger Yetzer Hara. If you're bigger than them, you have a bigger Yetzer Hara. You couldn't have lived up to Yetzer Hara because you would have had a bigger Yetzer Hara. So our perspectives, when we look at things, are from our small level. We have a smaller Yetzer Hara, we have a smaller Yetzer Tov. We don't begin to understand what it means to fight for the Jewish people, to speak good for the Jewish people. Our whole perspective is different. We don't begin to enter their realm. We don't admit to ourselves what we would have fallen on, what we would have succeeded on. We're not there. But Moshe Rabbeinu was, and at some level it was lacking. Okay. You want something, Zev?
Well, I don't know. It seems to me, and this has been my experience for a long time, that we ascribe, the Torah, the giant Torah, as we do of God. We speak about them in the same way, with the same reverence, the same inability to, we have to acknowledge that we're absolutely capable of understanding them, that we're human, and that the point of the Torah, to me it seems, is to be able to share those parts of the leaders that we have the capability to develop within ourselves, and to say that, oh, well, we're not on that level, we'll never understand. Seems to me to discourage the emergence of another leader who can come out of any one of us. And I don't know.
I think there's a balance. I think that on the one hand, that's why we mentioned all these understandings, because we do have to take a lesson from it. On the other hand, when we mention it, we have to understand that we have to take the lesson on our level, but we can't bring them down to our level and apply it to them. What in truth happened over there is beyond our comprehension. What the lesson that we could take from it is within our comprehension. It's two different things.
Well, I mean, we can't understand what happened to them on the very simple level of us not having been there, not knowing what it was like. But it seems to me that the point is not to bring them down to our level, it's to bring us up to their level. In order for, you know, I heard about this interesting mashal that we are like a tunnel. In the beginning, the Kedusha was so strong on us, we had so much Nevuah, and our leaders were on such a high level. There was this light at the beginning of the tunnel. In the middle of the tunnel, everything was dark, and as Nevuah comes, the light will come back to us. And it seems to me that if we're going to really have an ultimate Gula, then we need to have
a leader that's going to, or a whole leadership that's going to attain the level of the Yasharim, the original leaders of the Prophet Israel. Otherwise, it's not really sort of it's anticlimactic everything.
Okay, so that's Bezrat Hashem on a Thursday night. That's a long discussion. I want to take the last 5 minutes to quickly review what we can of the beginning of the Book of Bamidbar till here. We'll see how far we can get. Yeah? We said we'll try to do a review at the end of each 4 weeks. So, we began the Book of Bamidbar. We're holding the second year when the Jews left Egypt. We have a commandment to count the Jewish people. Moshe Rabbeinu counted the Jewish people together with the Nisi'im. We have a counting, the different numbers. The Levim aren't counted as part of the Jewish people. They're counted separately from age 30 and up. 30 days and up, I'm sorry. Moshe Rabbeinu is concerned, how do I count the Levim? Am I going to go into every nursing mother's tent that's immodest? God tells him, you do yours, I'll do mine. And when Moshe Rabbeinu goes to count them, so every time he approaches the entrance of a tent, so God tells him how many are in that tent. God divides the jobs of the different families of the Levim, which one carries the poles, which one carries the curtains, which one carries the holy vessels. And we enter Parshas Noso with the counting of the family of Kehat, that's Moshe Rabbeinu's family, and they have the Holy of Holies. They're the ones that carry the Holy of Holies when they travel. We're going through Noso, the different numbers, the countings. We have the story of if a person has tzaras or he's a zav. These are different forms of tumah that come from within the body, a blemish on the skin that is tameh, or some kind of flow that's similar to a seminal discharge, and they have to leave the tents, they have to leave the camps. The Torah tells us what happens if a person steals from Hegdish. So if he steals a holy thing, he has to pay back its value plus a fifth. The Torah tells us if a man's wife, he sees her behaving improperly with another man, he's not sure what went on there, he could warn her, please do not be seen alone with him again. And if she does, then he takes her up to the temple, and we have the procession of the Sota. If she sinned, then she explodes. If not, then she gets a blessing and she has blessed children. The Torah tells us if one wants to take a vow, a special vow of a Nazir, he may, and then he has to grow his hair and not eat wine or grapes or anything that comes from the grapes, like the grape peel, the seed, or raisins. We said the juxtaposition is to teach us if someone sees the embarrassment that a Sota undergoes, he should recognize that this stems from the fact that she was lightheaded. Her husband warned her not to be alone with this man. She was lightheaded. And this is supposed to drive him to try and be more careful. And wine is one of the things that causes a person to be lightheaded. When a person finishes his nizirut, he shaves his head, he brings 3 kobanot, he burns his hair under one of the kobanot, and then his nizirut is over. The Torah tells us the blessings of the Kohanim, that they bless the Jewish people. When Moshe finishes erecting the Mishkan, so he anoints it, and the Nesim bring their sacrifices, and we discuss the importance of the secrets of why each Nasi brought that sacrifice. We're holding Parshas Ma'alosra. God gives the commandment of how to light the special menorah. God tells him that they should all be facing the middle candle, and Aaron lights it the way God told him. He has a special step leading up to the menorah. He's supposed to leave the flame by the wicks until the flame goes up on its own. The menorah is all made of one solid piece of gold. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know how to do it. God made it for him. The Levim are purified. They're all shaved bald. They're sprinkled upon. They have the whole procession. They're waved back and forth. And the Levim are taken in place of the firstborn to serve God. And here we have the redemption of the firstborn. Those that are left over are redeemed with money. And we're holding towards the end of Baal Oscha. God tells them to do the Korban Pesach. We're holding the second year in the desert. They bring their Paschal offering. This is the only Paschal offering they're going to bring throughout the 40 years, because the 40 years in the desert, it was questionable whether it was dangerous to do a Bris Milah or not. And it was a level of danger where each one's allowed to call the shot on his own. Sometimes it's a level of danger where the rabbis say, if you're concerned, don't do Bris Milah. If you're not concerned, do Bris Milah. And that was the level, and all of the Jewish people other than the Levim were concerned. So no one else did a Bris Milah, and that's why they couldn't bring their Paschal offering the rest of the 40 years they were in the desert. There were people who were impure, they were Tameh, and they couldn't do the Paschal offering. They said, we don't want to be left out. And thanks to them, we have the mitzvah Pesach Sheni, that a month later, one who could not participate in the Korban Pesach can bring Pesach Sheni, and a Ger can as well. We travel following the Anon, and when we were traveling, God told Moshe to make special trumpets of solid silver that only he used to gather and tell the people when they were going. And we have a mitzvah when we go to war, we blow trumpets and we pray to God to save us. And this is reflective of the Jewish faith that God watches over what happens, and that's why we pray to him in a time of need. And we're holding Chamishi in Baal Oscha, Be'ezrat Hashem. Next week we'll begin our class maybe with finishing the review up to next week's parsha, and then go forward.